Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Well, the Israeli army confirmed this morning that the bodies of six hostages were recovered from Gaza's southern area of Khan Yunis today. And that news comes as the latest push for a ceasefire deal sees the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken calling on Hamas to accept a US bridging proposal deal. This is following talks in Tel Aviv with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. Well, for more on all of this, we're joined by Chief International Correspondent with the London Independent, Belle True. Belle, thank you very much for being with us this morning. Can I come first to that news I just mentioned about the recovery of the bodies of six hostages? What can you tell us about that?
Yes, the military said it's identified the remains and brought returned the remains of six hostages. The oldest is 80 Haim and the youngest is 35 Yagev. Now, these six individuals, they're all male. They were all abducted from two different kibbutzes, kibbutz near Oz and Nirim, on the 7th of October. Some of them have, back in June, I believe, were confirmed to have died within Gaza. The Israeli military put out a statement. More recently, Abraham, who is 79, was confirmed killed by members of his community in Gaza. So obviously, this is putting a lot of pressure on the ceasefire negotiations, because the families of the hostages that remain in Gaza are desperate for their loved ones to be returned alive. The concerns are the longer they spend in Gaza under fire with limited access to water, food and medicines, the more likely they are to die. And so pressure has mounted. I was speaking to friends of these individuals who told me that they said that now is the time to come to a ceasefire. Now is the time to bring back the rest of the hostages alive. And that though they're grateful to have the bodies that they can now bury, it's a painful reminder of all the others who are left in Gaza. There's at least over 110 still left in Gaza.
Yes, and I know we've spoken many times and you've had regular contact with many of the families who are agonizingly waiting for the return of their loved ones. And as you say, it ramps up pressure now on this proposal from the Americans, Antony Blinken saying that his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu was very constructive. But what do we know about this bridging proposal? Because there seems to be very little detail as to what exactly is in it.
Well, I think the reason there's little detail being made public is because there's little understanding of what is actually going to be agreed upon. Finally, there's been some really fraught discussions over some of the more difficult sticking points that have been problematic now for several months. What we understand is it's going to be a three-phased deal that would see the release of the hostages, that it would include possibly include the partial withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. That's at least Hamas's demand. The problem is, from the Israeli side, they want to retain control over what is known as the Philadelphia corridor, which is along the border region with Egypt, because they're concerned about smuggling of weapons. The other sticking point is whether the Israeli forces will withdraw from the north of Gaza and will allow the displaced families, Palestinian families, to return. At the moment, it's unclear exactly what's been agreed upon, what will be agreed upon. Hamas has been the most negative in terms of its public statements, saying that Netanyahu is deliberately scuppering this deal. The Israelis are talking about cautious optimism. Meanwhile, the Americans, the Qataris and the Egyptians who are mediating these talks are saying this is basically a last chance. This is a decisive moment, and that they believe that they have been able to bridge those gaps. But again, the differences in the visions of what both sides want from this ceasefire deal appear to be huge, and we'll have to see in the coming days if this deal is able to be satisfied by both sides.
All right, Belle, thank you very much for bringing us the latest detail on that. That's Belle True from the London Independent. Well, for more on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, I'm also joined by Dr. Javed Abdelmonim from Medecins Sans Frontières, who has just returned from there. Good morning, Dr. Abdelmonim.
Morning, Claire. Thank you for having me.
So, as I say, you've just returned. You were there for 2 months in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Will you tell us a little bit about conditions in Nasser Hospital, where you were based during that time?
Well, Nasser Hospital is under a lot of strain. It is the last remaining major hospital in the southern part. And after the closure of the European Gaza Hospital, which is EGH down in Rafah, it became very overcrowded in the hospital with an excess of patients for beds. This is in the context of working in a humanitarian space, so-called, that's supposed to be safe and very, very overcrowded with people who herded there with serial evacuation orders, forcing them to be displaced. And of course, we mustn't forget that the healthcare workers themselves, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, all the support staff to run a hospital are people living through this as well. People displaced themselves, people living in tents, people who have loved ones killed. So coming to work is very, very difficult, and yet they continue because it's what medics do.
But what was it like for you? I mean, did you have a safe place to stay? Did you have to remain in the hospital when you were off shift? How did all of that work?
Well, we in MSF, we have a mechanism, as do all humanitarian organisations everywhere, actually, in all conflict zones, called deconfliction, which means you notify the presence of your guest house, of your teams, so to speak, so either in the hospital or base where office and beds are, to all warring parties, so as to ensure that it's a safe a location to sleep at, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, my Palestinian colleagues don't have that. They're with their families dispersed around the Gaza Strip. And I should also say that I was at Nasser Hospital. That was one of the three projects over which I was the medical team leader. Another is a medical point inside the humanitarian zone down in Al-Mawasi, Khan Yunis. But the other is a clinic up in Gaza City, to which we have no access and no safety to stay as international staff. And that's been run exclusively by my Palestinian colleagues for months now. I was only able to make one trip to Gaza City in the 2 months that I was there. And of course, then we can't deconflict anything up in Gaza City.
And what about what you had to work with? Did you have enough supplies to do the job that you needed to do and to do the job for your staff to do the job that they needed to do in those crisis situations?
Supplies were undependable, and certainly since the Rafah invasion, beginning of May, very, very erratic. And for example, to give you some detail, the eighth shipment, our internal eighth shipment, you know, should have arrived really just at the beginning of May, and it was at the border ready to come in. But by the time I left on July the 31st, all of that one shipment still hadn't entered. And what that meant on the shop floor, so to speak, was that we'd ruptured in many very essential items, even, for example, ibuprofen, simple painkillers, or examination gloves, or surgical gowns, which we then had to have sewn and manufactured by tailors, or physiotherapy equipment, so crutches, wheelchairs, none of that. In Gaza, when you've got injured patients, broken limbs, amputated limbs, how do people cope without crutches or wheelchairs, right? Mm-hmm. So these are essential items for the services that we needed to run. Dressings, we were so short in dressings, we had to change our approach to how we do dressings in our burns unit there in Nasser. So we reduced the frequency of changing from 2 to 3 days to 3 to 4 days. And that's not hygienic in the heat, the humidity, people living in tents and sandy tents on beaches. Having to reduce the frequency of dressing changes increases the chance of infections. And other drugs as well, which are so essential for anesthesia, for example, fentanyl. There was an internal bartering marketplace between all the organizations. You know, I have an excess of sutures, but I'm low on fentanyl. What can you do for me? Well, yes, let's swap. I need sutures. You know, to and fro every day. It became a work stream of its own when all we needed was just to have our supplies come in.
And how does it compare to other war zones you've been in? Because I understand this is your seventh, isn't it, in your work with MSF?
Yes, this is my seventh war, and it was different and unique in one particular circumstance, which is the population are able to move away for safety in other contexts that I've been in, but not so in Gaza. And in fact, are exposed to daily military action. And that's why there are huge mass casualty events day in, day out, even from strikes within the so-called humanitarian zone. And I'm talking numbers of, you know, just in my emergency room in Nasser, right? Not across the other field hospitals, I'm talking of numbers of 150, 190, 230 on each occasion, injured people, with 20 to 80 dead on each occasion. And these are children and civilians and even healthcare workers amongst them in this so-called safe zone.
Mm. I know you've been in these types of situations before. You're a professional, you have a job to do, but I wonder how you come home and deal with what you have seen, what you've endured, what you've seen your colleagues go through, and you're sitting there today knowing that that's being repeated every day.
I think it's difficult. I'm aware that I'm carrying a lot of grief for that many avoidable deaths. You know, the loss of life, it's sacred in that, but just people being killed day in, day out. I'm grieving for people who should be alive. I'm carrying a lot of fear for my staff members, my colleagues, people who became my friends over the 2 months, because I've seen them shaking in fear when there was a strike that happened less than 100 meters away from where they're living, knowing that they've just got away with their lives. And I'm just waiting. I'm fearful just to get a message to say such and such has been killed today, because we've already had colleagues killed in MSF.
We also have these efforts now at a ceasefire, which are being spearheaded by America and the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, who's there in the Middle East now. And this is considered to be a last gasp deal. But do your colleagues have hope that something will give at this stage?
I think it's been a very long time, this war. And if my colleagues ever expressed any emotion to me, because it's difficult to talk about what they're enduring day in, day out, and what they're exposed to, what they expressed to me was a lack of hope, a despair, because we've been at this junction how many times? How many times have we been at a point of having a negotiation and they failed? So, you know, there's that old adage that doing something time and time again in the same way and expecting a different outcome. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've seen this 5, 6, 7 times in 10 months, you know, even the most hopeful person might start to say, well, I'll see it when I believe it. I'll believe it when I see it even, sorry.
Do you plan to go back?
I don't at this stage. I'm taking time out and no plans to go back at the moment.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much for joining us and for telling us about it. That's Dr. Javed Abdelmonim. And we wanted to mention as well that MSF is hosting a free public event on the crisis, both in Gaza and in Sudan, at the Triskell Arts Centre in Cork on the 5th of September, featuring first-hand updates from returned medical staff, and registration is at msf.ie.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.